Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed at our club night, as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the musician and composer Warren Ellis, a key member of iconic bands The Dirty Three and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. The multi-instrumentalist has cut a brilliant and unorthodox figure in music for over three decades. Far from the international concert halls in which he has plied his craft, lies a very different passion project, a wildlife sanctuary in the forests of Sumatra. Co-founded by Warren Ellis and spearheaded by Femke Den Haas, whose dedicated team of conservationists rescue trafficked and mistreated animals and then devote years nursing them back to health. I spoke to Warren about how the film offers both a deeply personal insight into an artist's life through the act of creating and an inspiring reminder of how much can be achieved when passionate people come together.
The things that happened with puppies and he sat in, I think, fox shit as we were about to leave. And so I couldn't navigate that and change out of my tracksuit that I'd been in all day in the studio. So Buffalo had to stay behind, but we have Piglet with us tonight.
Sorry, I'm very distracted.
Yeah, that's why I bought her. I feel like your tracksuit trousers during lockdown at the moment. I've been coming out from a five-day cold that wasn't COVID, but I managed to watch four different versions of The Count of Monte Cristo in the last 4 days, and I'm here tonight. But I do feel like those tracksuit trousers that you wore during the first lockdown in 2020.
So, Warren, we had a discussion down in Brighton a few days ago about this film, and in the conversation you said that this film had a really profound effect on your life. I was wondering if you could just give the audience a bit of a background on that and how it affected you.
Okay, well, initially when this was pitched to me, it was pretty much a bunch of Australians talking about what we'd been doing during COVID. And I was having a coffee with Justin Kurtzell, who directed this, and I knew his work, but I didn't really know him. And he asked what I'd been doing during lockdown, and, you know, I'd made a record with Nick called Carnage and a record with Marianne Faithfull, and I'd written a book and opened an animal sanctuary. And he's like, what do you mean? And I said, well, I opened an animal sanctuary. And he's like, what's it like? And I said, I don't know, I've never been there. But this is typically Australian, where you kind of beef up an idea in order to impress everyone around you. And it was the truth. But, well, I'd tried to get a sort of 3-meter version of Nina Simone's gum made in Italy out of pink marble, and I'd approached the Louvre and they just looked at me like, and I approached the Musée d'Orsay and I was in there and I had the first piece of music ever to be performed. Hey, sweetheart, sit down, baby. I had the first bit of music ever performed and I thought, that's going to give me a leg up. And I told them and they said, yeah, no, look, it's really been tough, the COVID, on their finances. So I just thought, fuck them. I'm going to build my own and take it to Ellis Park. And I told Justin this story, and I knew from the photos there was a river, because you have to bear in mind, do I look like a guy with a plan? Like, I'm really not. When I sort of got this idea to help Femke out build the park, I knew fuck all about it. Like, as much as I knew about trying to make a soundtrack when I went in and did the proposition in 2004, I had absolutely no clue what to do. It just felt like a good idea. And she seemed, as you can see from this, she's like the best of us. She's just this, I mean, since Jane Goodall's passing, Femke is like Jane Goodall with a fucking tattoos and a mohawk. Like, she's absolutely dedicated her life to saving these animals, but also something that she's not responsible for. She wants to right a wrong. of these animals that don't have a voice unless we give them one. And I guess that's kind of what really attracted me to it, and her enthusiasm, and that she just built this place on the smell of nothing. And it really reminded me of being gorgeous, being in Dirty Three, like a little band in the 90s, running around on heroin and alcohol and a bit of speed, and just like, you know, fucking getting to the gig and like feeling such a sense of accomplishment. I really respected that, and I really related to it with her and her team. So I didn't know anything more. I didn't even know we had to build the fucking thing until they told me, well, now we have to build it. And I was like, what? You know, and that's when I went public with it, and some of you here probably got behind it, which I thank you very much for that, because that provided me with this incredible sense of community that I just wasn't aware of. I knew the music that I made reached people, and you know that, because being a musician, you're in this incredibly privileged position to get feedback from people engaging in what you do, and it doesn't work without you. The concert doesn't work without you. And, you know, I kind of sensed that, but I knew that feeling. But when I threw this out into the public, I had no idea that this caring community would spring up around, and fans from the band, that some of them might be here tonight, the Trinity Club, they just kind of, you know, got together and sold my old shirts, and some of you probably bought my shoes, you know, I don't know. Like, I have this shit lying around the house that means something to some people, and I know people who have stuff and that means something to somebody else, and they started saying, here, sell this, sell that, auction this, raffle this, you know. And this is going to sound weird, but you know, selling T-shirts and stuff like that is kind of really unsatisfying. I think I'd reached a point in my life where I just wanted to put something back into a system that had been incredibly kind to me. And I was in a position to enable these people to do their better work, I guess. Anyway, I was telling Justin about this, like, you know, I'm going to fucking go over there and I've sourced this thing and I'm going to take it down the river and, you know, drag it up the hill. And he just goes, well, I was. And he's like, well, God, you're so gorgeous. She was like a crack addict shit the other day at the Rio. The little guy pissed all over the stage as well. She's amazing tonight. I was going to drag it up the hill, and he just goes, well, I want to make this film. And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah, I want to film this. And Nick Batsius, the producer, he's like, well, I want to produce that film. And I was like, okay. And then that night, Justin sent me a text, and he said, I'm serious. I want to make a film. And I didn't think anything of it. And then a month later, he sent me a synopsis, which I didn't read. I just was like, wow, you're like, fuck, it's a synopsis, you know. I didn't look at it until I was over touring Australia with Nick doing a Carnage tour. It was a scaled-down version of a band playing songs off Ghosteen and Carnage predominantly. And I got down to the lobby and I said, where are we going? And they said, well, we're going to Ballarat. And I said, what do you mean we're going to fucking Ballarat? And he's like, well, it was in the synopsis. And I'm like, well, you can't, like, I'm not responsible. We can't go there. And the reason this changed my life was that it made me confront something. Like, every time I went back there, no matter, you know, I've played some of the greatest venues in the world, and I've been incredibly lucky with my professional life. But going back there reduced me to this 5-year-old kid that had kind of been the foundation, I think, of of my life, and it was defining me in ways that I didn't know. And you know, I battled drugs in the 90s and alcohol. You know, I did heroin, whatever, you name it, you know. And then, you know, I did therapy and I did Primal Scream therapy, which was really wild, and AA and NA and all that stuff. But I didn't know why I had this compulsion to take things. I had to go to the kind of final end of things. Like for me, the way that I gave up was deciding, the way I gave up alcohol and drugs was I said, okay, I'm getting on the plane. My friend had died. I couldn't face the funeral. I got on the plane and I'd been in on a couch pissing myself and like, you know, I was in a mess. And I just said, look, if I wake up in Paris and I'm alive, I'm giving up. That's just the kind of way that I operate. It's all or nothing. I woke up and I said, okay, this is when I stop. And anyone having problems, the only way that you will stop is when you decide yourself. That's the only way I've ever found myself personally, is to make that promise to yourself that you will. You can't do it for anybody or anything else. It has to be for you. And that's, for me, was the first step, I didn't realize, of actually caring about myself, which I found very hard to do. Most of my life, I found that very difficult. And music was a way for me to kind of escape the real world. And it was like the greatest thing, the greatest gift for me was to just immerse myself in music. And that's what I've done until now. I'm 60. So yeah, I was quite extreme in that sense. You know, I had to kind of give myself this ultimatum. I woke up and I cleaned up. But I hadn't, I don't know, I did a lot of therapy and stuff, and I could never work out why my foundation was so shattered and why I seemed to be defined by this stuff that I had no control over. Like, why would I meet somebody and 24 hours later decide to follow them around to the other side of the world, and when they're not there, sink into a depression at 21 and think, like, why am I so fucking needy? So there was a lot of stuff, and then I realized, I'm sorry, this is a long answer to a very simple question, but it is a Q&A, so it's one question, one answer. And stop me if this is driving anyone crazy, because we can talk about what I feed the dogs or something. But I realized getting in the car that it was like just getting in a time machine and everything twisted inside me. And suddenly I wasn't this guy. You know, I wasn't that guy. Like, I was kind of this person that I knew that I didn't know how to navigate things, and Justin saw me spin out of control really quickly, and he just said, okay, look, and I will be grateful to him for the rest of my life for this. He said, listen, we've got the crew here. We can go there, see what happens. You're at a really important moment in your life. I had all this stuff going on. I was separating. I'd fallen in love. I had a lot of stuff, just life stuff, but it was all going on, and I was playing to 10,000 people a night. I basically sort of had this monumental fucking breakdown in the car, and he just said, listen, you're at an important time in your life. I would encourage you to be open to this. This guy just thought we were going back to shoot a couple of things in Ballarat, me eating fish and chips and all this stuff. And he's got this person having a, you know, total existential crisis. And I called Andrew Dominic, who I've worked with on several films, The Assassination of Jesse James, Blonde, the two documentaries, the one on Nick, When His Son Dies, One More Time with Feeling, and This Much I Know to Be True. And I called Andrew and I said, fuck, Andrew, I don't know what to do. Like, Justin's asking something from me that I can't do. And he just said, trust him. Trust the process. Throw yourself into it. You will get something out of it. And so on the strength of that, I did. Now, what Justin did was he enabled me enough room. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that he took out of the film because, you know, I don't know if anyone's been through this, but when you have some trauma in your childhood, you can just run away from it, which is what I did, and just let it build up. And one day a big tsunami of shit will fall on you and then you have to deal with it. And I guess that had been part of my reasoning for just obliterating myself all the time. I don't really know. But Justin was amazing. He just said, where did you feel safe? And I just said, well, the gardens, there was this statue I loved, and the church, I really loved that there, and the countryside, and the cinema. And he said, okay, let's go and play there. And he took me, and I thought it was kind of naff. And then I just thought, okay, I'm going to trust him. And it was amazing because in some way he enabled me to reclaim these places as a 58-year-old guy. And I felt amazing. It was like doing 50 something years of therapy in a couple of days. And I kind of went come bouncing out of there and then went into rehearsals and we did the tour. And then my dad's, you know, like my mum went into a home, my dad, which is touched on in there. My father then said to me, once mum was out of the picture, explained to me that the relationship had been abusive, and the whole marriage. And this wasn't news to me, but it was news to hear it from him and to also realize that it was ongoing. So, you know, I kind of kept barreling on playing the shows and, trying to sort of check in with my dad and all that. But it really threw me and I stayed on, looked after him for a month, went to Sumatra, got back and then just had a massive nervous breakdown that lasted when we finished the demos for Wild God. I just went down this rabbit hole and I had been also prescribed benzodiazepines. If anyone's ever been on them, I wish you well getting off them because heroin has got nothing on those things. And I jumped off them and just went insane. And I'm very grateful that it happened now in retrospect because I attribute the making of this film to me now having a different life from that moment on. Once the shit had settled and once, you know, I saw a psychiatrist and all these things, like once that stuff had settled, I realized that and it's just life stuff that I'm sure a lot of you go through at some point. Once that stuff had settled, that life wouldn't be the same for me because I was coming from a different place, if that makes sense. So, yeah, it's probably the most important creative thing I've ever been involved in on a personal level. You know, music, I kind of make it and like it has to be the best that I can do and that's my only criteria. If it's the best that I can do and I've evolved, then I'm really happy for it to go out. This was a different thing because I'm pretty private. Nobody's really interested in my fucking what goes on outside of that. So, you know, I'm happy with that, you know. This was suddenly I was like throwing it all out there. Stuff that I hadn't even really spoken about to many people at all. So there's a, I don't know, there was something now, I'm 2 years away from it, and, you know, I'm really grateful Justin gave me the space to kind of find my relationship to what was going on at the time within there, and that I can elaborate on it now. And I think it was very beautifully edited, the way that they touch on stuff, but they'd leave enough room for you to put yourself in there if you need to. So, yeah. What was really weird was I just thought we were, you know, and I do believe the film is primarily to shine a light on the amazing work that these people are doing there. I truly think they're, you know, they're if there's a thing of doing God's work, then they're doing it. And what I mention it in the film, but what I saw there, the principles and the way that they operate was so akin to like what we think is the way to be, but we can't quite do it because, you know, you got to keep a roof over your head or it can be hard sometimes. And I found it very hard, mainly I think because I just didn't like myself very much at all. So, yeah, it was a big one for me, this.
And what was the experience like going to Sumatra? I know you had a few near-death experiences.
Well, Justin would call his brother every day and go, you won't fucking believe what just happened. And so every day I think he almost killed me. The first instance was Rena, the monkey that I kind of, you know, decided to do it all on. I just couldn't believe what she'd lived through and her spirit and all that. Justin had this great idea to like for me to go in the cages and play, and he's yeah, I know, you fucking, I arrived there in a suit, and I'm like, one day later I'm covered in monkey shit and meerkat shit and like sitting there playing the violin, you know, like, is this a good idea, Justin? Like this, he goes, mate, it's great, you know, like this, and just kept rolling. And I mean, this film could only be made by an Australian because Justin understood where I came from, and he had a sense of humour about the whole thing, but a seriousness. And Australian art, when it's at its best, it's poetic, it's savage, it is sacred, it is profane. There's always a sense of humour, but when Australian art is at its best, we are deadly serious because, you know, like it's a career move. Like to decide to be a heroin addict in the 80s was a career move. Like it really was, you know. Like, I mean, like we went out of our way to do it. Like and to the people we looked up to were writers and directors and musicians, artists, not so much. But I mean, just because, you know, we were listening to music and reading and watching films, and I don't think we understood art. We didn't understand the art. I got thrown out of the main gallery in Melbourne in the 80s. If anyone has a photo of that, it would be really, it would come back and haunt me, that's for sure. But it was like, that's what we aspired to be. They were like the touchstones for us. And Justin comes from this very serious background, but also he has, you know, humor and he's dry. And Justin was able to kind of, and the editor were able to sort of make something out of this. I think only an Australian would have jumped on board with this whole idea, to be honest. And Justin kind of, you know, got me out there, and he's like, go in and play to Rena. And his big moment in the film was when I would soothe Rena by playing the violin, which anyone knows my violin playing, I'm out of tune, out of time, and fucking, you know, God knows what. I'm like, Justin, this won't work. And he's like, no, believe me, this is going to be amazing, you know. So I go into the cage, and this is the kind of coolest, kindest monkey on the planet. And the cameraman, Jermaine McMicking, who's just extraordinary. He just dances around in all these really sensitive moments with my parents. He was amazing. he's like, yeah, I spent a week with her and she was giving me kisses and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, cool. He's like, yeah, no, she's the sweetest. I walked in there into the cage, and within about 10 seconds, Rena had ran over the top of the carer's shoulder and lunged at me, and I saw these teeth coming at me. So all I could do, I had my violin, like, and Justin's like, play the violin. So all I could do was with the violin and hold it up like that in the bow, and Femke grabbed Rena like this by the scruff of the neck. This is all filmed. It just couldn't get in because we're meant to be an animal sanctuary. And I could hear the producer, Nick Batsius, and he's a big, like, authoritative guy, and he just went, get him out. And Justin went, I looked at Justin like, and he goes, hold position. So I picked up the violin and started playing again, and she ran up over my shoulder this time and lunged at me, like, with her mouth. I was fucking terrified. So they grabbed her again, and I heard Nick Batsius, get him out. And then Justin said, hold position. So then they swapped. They figured it's because she was threatened. There was another man in there and another woman and da-da-da-da-da like that. So I'm trembling in my little winkle pickers at this stage, you know. I'm just sitting there. And I start up again, and she just lunged at me, like, seriously, came charging at me. They grabbed her, and I heard, get him out. And Justin said, get out of the cage, Warren. So I got out, but that's all, that'll be in the extras on the DVD. And, like, then Justin had this other idea, which you see is me with this sort of Apocalypse Now lighting, and I'm sitting there playing a synthesizer. And it's all going really nice, and they're getting their shots, and they're setting up all the rails and things like that. Hello. And suddenly I hear, I said, what's that? And the guy goes, snake. And there's this fucking boa constrictor, this big boa constrictor coming towards me. So they all go in and wrestle it and get it with a stick and put it in a pillowcase that's sitting next to me on the truck the next day when we go to release the eagle. This fucking snake just crawling around in the bag that they let go because, I mean, these people, look, they're these two white monkeys there, and sadly, it's the jungle there, but a snake got in and ate one of them, right? And these people managed to get the snake to regurgitate the monkey just to check that it wasn't dead. And I got all these photos that were, like, really horrific. You know, this is why I get my WhatsApp in the morning, you know. I'm trying to write a song for a Bad Siege record and I suddenly get this, like, half-digested monkey appear on my WhatsApp. And I said, oh, what happened to this? Did you cut it out? And they went, no, no, no. We made it vomit and we've released it where we released the other one. Like, these people are incredible. Like, they don't, you know, even when you think you need to hit it on the head with a shovel, they don't they don't do that, you know. So there was the snake, and then I'm standing there and Justin's on the phone. He's like, fuck, you won't believe it. Warren nearly got eaten by a snake yesterday. And I swear suddenly there was this, like, thud. And this coconut fell out of the tree and just landed in front of me like that. And he's like, fuck, you won't believe it. He's talking to Justin, his brother. You won't believe it. He's only got hit, killed by a coconut. And the next day we shot the scene on the water, you know, on the boat. And I'm sitting there, you know, by this stage I'm in my shorts and stuff. I've just given up on all fucking civilization. I'm having the time of my life, waking up naked, sitting in this treehouse, like, you know, with the windows open, the doors, listening to the call to prayer, watching the rain crash down, the lightning and stuff like this. You know, it was like waking up in a book, childhood book, you know. And he's like, why don't you dive in? And I went, oh, fuck, yeah, good idea, you know, like this. And so I'm about to jump in and I hear this, sharks. So it was like four times Justin nearly made an opening for a violin player in Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and the Dirty Three. And when we were shooting in Ballarat, my violin, which is, you know, of some significance to someone. It's, you know, I've used it on every recording since the Boatman's Call, I guess, you know, or something like that, 20 years. And I was charged with the responsibility of putting it in the trunk, and you had to press a button to close the thing. And I just, that's, you know, I come from the 80s with cars, you just slam it. We take off and my violin suddenly flies out the back of the car, goes bouncing down the road, slams on the brake. Justin runs out and he's like, oh, my God, and opens it up and it's just cracked and broken and stuff like that. But by that stage, I just didn't care anymore. And I had it, got it glued up, and it's fine. But I will say, just to go circle back, the funny thing is, you know, we had this idea, you know, I'd take this like 3 meter piece of gum on a boat and sail it from Italy, and like they were going to film me and then put it on a little boat and take it up the river and drag it up. And they went over on rec, which is reconnaissance, if you're not in the business. They call me from the airport and he goes, Justin goes, hey, mate, I think we might have a few problems trying to get the gum up the river. And I'm like, what, alligators or something like that? And he goes, nah, mate, like it barely comes up to your ankles, the river. So it was just this little trickle of water that ran around. And you know, the amazing thing, the idea for this, you know, which was, as I say, to shine a light on the park and what's going on in these people, the idea that kickstarted it absolutely fell by the wayside. And I was on the plane, I was on a boat or I can't remember, a fucking bus or something, and we were touring with the Bad Seeds, and Nick goes to me, how's the film coming? I go, it's going to be so awesome, like, I'm going to take this bit of chewing gum, we're going to drag it up the hill. And he just goes, well, it sounds a bit grotesque. And I said, what do you mean grotesque? And he's like, well, the book is this beautiful little thing and this beautiful kernel of an idea, but I don't know, like, I could be wrong, but blowing it up to 3 meters is maybe grotesque. Anyway, so I'm sitting there in a hotel in somewhere fucking, where's I prepared from? Estonia. I was in Estonia and I'm having a conference with Nick and Justin, the director. And I'm like, look, you know, Nick thinks it might be a bit grotesque, the three-meter chewing gum. And Justin's like, yeah, I've been wondering that too. Like, I think we might end up with something built out of chicken wire and plaster. And Bats, the producer's like, I think it needs to be 5 meters tall. Like, it's got to be bigger. And I had the copy that Andrew Muller Mister made that you see in the film. And I was just, I had it with me all the time. I was just playing catch with it as I did. And I said, yeah, maybe we need smaller. And he goes, yeah, like something like that thing you're throwing in up in the air. And what's that? And I said, well, actually, that's a piece of gum that Anne made in the shape of a heart. And he goes, that's what we need. And so we kind of, I don't know, the wonderful thing was the idea that launched it was, you know, exciting and all that, but we were prepared to let it just die. And that's my whole experience in the studio is, you know, the idea that kind of gets everybody excited often dies, but its great strength is that it got you to rally around this little thing and try and keep it alive. And, you know, the fact that it was in my hand also is, I think, of some significance because from my experience, the ideas are there. You just have to find them. They don't fall out of the sky. Like, I've never been hit. You know, I've worked 35 years. Like, the acts of serendipity are so few and far between. Ghostine is one. The whole record is like something else directed that. But that's like kind of a one-off thing for me. The rest of the time, it's just getting in there and chipping away and just working and working and working. Nothing gets given to you, at least it doesn't for me. I have to kind of work for it. But quite often I find that it is there in your hands already. You just have to kind of be emotionally aware of it. You know, you have to, when it turns you, when it moves you emotionally to jump on it, when it terrifies you or makes you feel uneasy, that's the time to jump on it. And I love that about the fact that this film was launched on an idea that just disappeared into the ether mostly. I even forgot why we went there after a while. I mean, the film is one take. There's nothing planned at all. And there's no reshooting of anything from memory.
Do you have any plans to go back to Sumatra?
Well, I would, but I've got to keep touring now to feed 2,000 animals.
There is a QR code on the screen if anyone would like to donate money to the sanctuary.
I do, but also I like to work because it defines me. And it's always been my way of coping. And in this instance, the experience I had making this made it impossible for me to work, and that had only, I mean, I've had about 4 or 5 breakdowns, I guess, in my life. They seem to happen like a reset, and I've always figured they were healthy. I always figured they were kind of healthy for me. But this, to the extent where I couldn't pack a suitcase, you know, like I was kind of fucked. Work has always been my way of just moving forward. I think it is for a lot of people too. So, yeah.
I think Piglet is signaling that it's time to go home. I'm very sorry we have not had any time for audience questions this evening. Time has got away from us.
Has anyone got a question?
Do you want to take one? I think we've got time. We've got time for one. Okay.
Thanks for sharing such a beautiful, profound film, Warren.
No, thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for coming out after feeling sick and everything. And I was just wondering, the quick question was, what about, you know, you're talking about breakdowns and, like, I love that you made that a positive thing and, like, that it's a turning point. And I was just wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like death. There's all different sorts, you know, and I'm not a specialist. I only know from my experience of these things. And for me, the thing I can see now, which I never knew at the time, to have this thread, like this, you know, even playing music at a very young age, it's like you're going to the gym and you're developing a certain muscle. And you can't expect to go into the gym after 6 months of not doing it. Oh, baby, come on. It's all right. He's all right. Yeah, you can't expect it to just bounce back into action. But I guess I just sort of kept playing and listening. And you know, I judge reading and I also put reading and which I used to do a lot of, not so much these days, but watching films, like it all felt like a way of building some kind of world, you know, that I could kind of function in and relate in some way to the outside world, which I found quite difficult. And, you know, when I'm in the studio or playing, like it kind of life makes sense to me because I'm in a moment and being in the present as well. And these dogs help me enormously to be in the present. She does therapy with me, like every week, sits there. Being in the present was very hard for me. And I thought it was an attribute for a long time. I still believe it is to be able to escape that. But I don't know. With me, it just came to a head where I had to kind of roll life and work into one thing and not separate. We won't be invited back to the cinema, will we, Piggy? Yeah, but, you know, I don't know if I'm an addict. I know that I have I'm obsessive about stuff, and most people I know are, and I see it as a, you know, that's like a creative person has this, and so I see it as a good thing. I didn't, but I do now. Like I don't paint myself as an addict. I think I'm, I don't know, like I, what am I trying to say? I don't know. I guess I always felt like that compulsion to do things and to react, like, you know, doing something like this. I mean, who in their right mind, like, you know, manager of the band goes, well, how much is it going to cost monthly to run it? I go, I don't fucking know. Like, who would ask that sort of question? But some people do. Understanding can destroy action sometimes. Like, you if you overthink stuff, I find I talk myself out of it. So I always, you know, I've fucked up. I will fuck up until I die. Like, I make mistakes and stuff like that. But I guess I've always tried to just get out and jump when I'm, you know, jump into something with all the enthusiasm that I can muster. So I never really, I didn't see whatever things that I have, I didn't see them as a problem. I didn't see them as a super strength or anything like that, but I you know, I know that I'm sensitive. And I'm all right with that. Yeah. I mean, I took, I was prescribed benzos because of anxiety. I mean, I never addressed what the anxiety was about. For 10 years, you know, like I was on them. And they helped me kind of, they just felt like they took the rough bits off and I could function. But, you know, they ended up just coming back and really biting me big time. That's when we were doing this, you know. I mean, I guess that's the other thing. I had a camera on me when all this stuff was going on, so it did heighten everything. Does that answer your question? In a way, or do you want to help me out a bit? I mean, I'm not a fucking, don't listen to what I say, but.
I was just curious.
I'm just talking about my experience.
I appreciate your honesty. I was just wondering, like, that thing you said about the breakdown being like a turning point. So I was like, should you go full force into create a project or have a breakdown? Like,
what was the timeline?
Like, I was just curious. No, I was not the timeline, more just like.
Well, when I didn't have anything to do, everything fell apart. And I guess my way of dealing with things was just push it like this and let it all build up. Then it would fall on top of me. And then, you know, I'd get up and run, you know, go off again. And then it would all build up again. And I guess this time, it was like I didn't have anything to jump back into. I had a couple of months, 3 or 4 months clear, and then I had to deal with it, you know. I mean, when I say turning point, like if I think of how I was before that happened, I would still have these, you know, conflicting relationships to things that, you know, I'm able to kind of shit bat away. I mean, you know, being truthful, which I'm loath to put it all back on I mean, I don't want to be defined by something. So I think that's important to point out in this. It's in the film too, you know, like I don't think my mum's a monster. My mum had something going on. I don't know why she was so unpredictable. You know, she would bake cakes one minute and be very sweet, and then the next minute you wouldn't know what was happening. And the psychological stuff was worse than the physical stuff as far as I was aware. But I never wanted to, I didn't want to be defined by that, but it just seemed to define me, you know. And I couldn't have this conversation with you before I made this film. I couldn't sit and talk the way that I am now comfortably. I mean, and I am very comfortable talking about this. I don't want to be seen as like, you know, what I'm saying is, I guess it's just my experience of things, and some people sort this out. I'm really glad younger. Some people sort it out when some people never do, and I'll always be sorting things out. But somehow it feels to me that this was a real defining moment for me, that I could have run back into my old ways and I could have just kind of barreled on, or, you know, just take it and then... And the psychiatrist I saw was amazing. You know, I'd done a lot of therapy, always going around in circles. And after two sessions, he just said, "You're a 58-year-old man. you're this. I recommend this." And I could understand that. It was like someone telling me I had diabetes and take this, you know. So he put me on antidepressants, and that was like, for me, a fucking life changer. Like, and weirdly, you know, my brother, my older brother, who is the only other person who, and my father, who really kind of could give me answers. My brother left home at 15, smashed the house up, beat everyone up, just fucking left screaming, you know. I didn't speak to him for 40 years. Like, we had 10 conversations. Now, when this happened, this film, he came back into my life. And my father allowed a freeing up by acknowledging things. And I think he needed to clear the air with me. This was a year before he died. And I'm really grateful for that, because it allowed me to go into his death in a very different way than if I had all these unanswered questions. And I can't talk to my mum, because she thinks a Lamington is the most extraordinary thing on the planet. And, you know, I mean, it's terrible seeing her. It's sad, you know. But I, you know, I couldn't get any, you know, I was at church and I was in the church when we were working at my dad's fucking funeral. And a neighbor from 50 years ago comes up and she goes, "Oh, I'm Barbara Wright, you know, I used to live next door," da da da, like that. And I said, "Oh, hi, you haven't changed." And she's like, "No, you haven't either." And she just said, "I know what your kids went through." And that was incredible for me to hear that, because I'd never heard that. Now, I'm not making out a monster, or I'm not making my mum out to be a monster. My mum loved us in the way that was possible. She was a victim of abuse as well from her mother and father. You know, it was passed on. I know when I had my kids, I looked at them and I said, "Right, this is not happening in my house." I know I made a conscious decision to shut the door on that. But I'm really, you know, I mean, I'm really, I just want to point out, I don't, you know, my mum's not a monster in all this. I don't know what she was coping. I don't know if something was undiagnosed. So that made this very hard for me to let go of certain things in this. But I came back to that notion of when I'm making stuff, if I'm uncomfortable, I'm in the right place. And I was really uncomfortable and really crazy when I had to sign off on this. And I let it go because, well, a few people had seen it and gave me their thoughts about it. But I also figured that if someone can see this and maybe speed up a conversation or know that they're not alone, and this just happens to people in life, then it's worth me feeling uncomfortable for and putting it out there. And you know, I know this is off the track, but you know, I'm very comfortable with this. I can't watch it. And what I'm focusing on is such a small part, I think, of a really extraordinary film and this place that's going on, and I don't want to draw it into to that. But I guess for me, you know, it was a big deal to finally kind of, you know, step up to it or something.
Please give a hand to Warren Ellis and Piglet. Thanks to the incredible Warren Ellis for joining me at Picture House Central. Ellis Park is now available to watch at home on Apple TV, BFI Player and Prime Video, and you can donate to the Animal Sanctuary at ellispark.org. Coming up at Scared to Dance, we have the return of the club night this Saturday, where Man, Woman, Chainsaw are our guest DJs at the Shackwell Arms. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week when I'll be talking to Jason Williamson from Sleaford Mods about their new album, The Demise of Planet X. This podcast was produced at Third Floor Recording.